Hello, good day. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker today is Susan Leal. Susan is a senior fellow at the Advanced Leadership Initiative and an associate of the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard University. She's a water utility expert, author, and consultant. She specializes in identifying realistic and creative solutions to the water and wastewater challenges that face many American cities and states. As part of her fellowship at Harvard, she has co-authored Running Out of Water, a book focused on solutions to our looming water crisis. She's a member of the advisory board of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Berkeley. As general manager of San Francisco's Public Utilities Commission, Ms. Leal led the charge for a dramatic upgrade of the Bay Area's seismically unsafe water system and San Francisco's outdated wastewater system. She previously served two terms as the elected treasurer of the City and County of San Francisco and earlier as a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Ms. Leal earned her law degree and her bachelor's degree in economics at UC Berkeley. Go Bears! So please welcome Susan Leal.
Thank you, Carrie, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for putting on this program. It's important for all of us to become members of the Commonwealth Club if we still want to have these programs. So just a little plug for the Commonwealth Club, which has been doing good work for many decades in this city and throughout California and the West. And I want to thank all of you for attending. It's great to see some familiar faces in the crowd, and some of them are even friendly faces. So that's good news. So what is the fascination with water? Or to be more specific, what is my fascination and that of my co-author, Peter Rogers? It starts out with our childhoods. No, this is not going to be a large group therapy session where we talk about my childhood, but we could. But for both of us, since our early childhood, we were fascinated and learned the importance of water. Peter, who is also known as Professor Rogers at Harvard University, has memories as a small child of his parents moving away from his home in Liverpool to the countryside. With that move, his family no longer had indoor plumbing. And he remembers it, and as he still says to me, remembers it like it was yesterday. For me, growing up in San Francisco, with my early education about earthquakes, it was impressed upon me that the city was not destroyed by the quake, but by the fires that burned out of control because there was no water. And then there was a childhood visit to the Pulgas Water Temple, the terminus of that wonderful water system that serves close to 2.5 million customers in the San Francisco Bay Area. My visit to the beautiful water temple sealed the deal. I was wowed forever by water and our water system, the water system I was lucky enough to run for several years. So it is natural that my focus would continue as I left the San Francisco Water Agency and began a fellowship in early 2009 at Harvard University. It was through this fellowship that I met the brilliant and visionary Peter Rogers. Around the time we met, Peter had just agreed to write a book about water that would be geared toward general audiences. Up to that time, Professor Rogers had written several books on water and related engineering topics that were primarily for academic and scientific audiences. Professor Rogers was grappling with what form his book would take. Then he made a very serious mistake. He asked me for my opinion. Enter the pushy, newly minted Harvard fellow, and whether he wanted it or not, his business became my business. And so began our collaboration on this book, Running Out of Water. I'm happy to report that it also began a lasting friendship. As we move forward, trying to decide on the form of our book, we realized that we needed to explain in everyday terms the serious problems of our waters, our world water. We also realize that while, yes, we could and should scare people, we did not want to write a doom and gloom book. So we decided that we could highlight some of the success stories in our water world. These case studies, which we describe in our book, are intended to celebrate a can-do, get-it-done attitude, as well as provide a roadmap to avert our water crisis. How bad is our water situation? It's bad. It's very bad. We are on a collision course between a finite water supply and an ever-growing demand. What do I mean by a finite source? While water covers 70% of our Earth, 70% of our Earth's surface, less than 1% is actually accessible to us. Or let me say it another way. We have had the same water on this planet since the beginning of time. And yet we now have 6.7 billion people using that water, with expectations of that number growing to 8 billion in less than 15 years. With our current population, we already have water supply stress. Water supply stress in over 30 states in the U.S. As an added complication, there's climate change. Climate change is already impacting water supply in several areas across the globe. Here at home, we're experiencing severe impacts in California with less snow and more rain. Remember, 60% of our water is stored in the snow. 60% of our water in California is stored in the snow. This natural storage system provides water over many months of the year. These days, everybody is concerned about energy and oil. The stark reality is that while there are substitutes for oil and energy, like solar, like wind, biofuels, there is no substitute for water. You cannot live without water, whether it's for growing our food or basic hygiene. Despite water being necessary for our survival, we continually fall short in our investments to maintain and upgrade the infrastructure that assures that we will continue to receive safe drinking water or clean up our wastewater. The General Accounting Office reports that every year our investments in our water infrastructure fall short by $20 billion. $20 billion a year our investment falls short in the U.S. Just recently, we got a reminder of what happens when we don't make adequate investment in our infrastructure. An article in the New York Times described the problems plaguing parts of Cape Cod. Because some of the Cape Cod towns had not invested in wastewater treatment systems and had relied on overloaded and outdated septic systems, their wastewater was seeping into the bays and was killing their shellfish beds. And I guess that water wouldn't be too great for swimming either. Okay, I think we can all agree we have a problem. So what are we going to do about it? The good news is that there are some individuals, water utilities, corporations, NGOs, and governments that are doing something to solve this problem. In our book, we focus on some of that good news. In some of our case studies, we described how utilities learn to use water in a more renewable fashion. What do I mean by that? It is important for us to keep in mind that for every drop we use, we have to dispose of that water. Okay? And how we dispose of that water will have an impact on our future water supply. Or in the case of Cape Cod, their food supply. In many cases, despite federal laws to the contrary, we return that water in a contaminated condition to lakes, rivers, and oceans, and we know what the result is. And in some cases, we dispose or throw away of water when we should be cleaning it up and using it again. This book describes those cases where utilities have started to see their wastewater as a resource instead of something simply to get rid of. A few of those success stories are close to home. I bet you didn't know that for 120 years, Santa Rosa used the Russian River, a favorite recreational river for us in the Bay Area, and a home to the endangered steelhead salmon, as the receiving waters for the town's wastewater, its sewer water. While it wasn't such a big deal when Santa Rosa was a small town, also to be fair, we didn't know any better. But as Santa Rosa grew, the discharge of its sewer water into the river became a serious problem. As we report in our book, with smart thinking and a partnership between Santa Rosa's government-run utility and Calpine, a private energy utility, they were able to turn Santa Rosa's sewer water into an asset. As we describe in the book, Calpine was trying to revive the geysers, the clean energy plant that uses steam coming up from the earth to produce clean, renewable energy. Calpine had just taken over the plant from PG&E as the plant was almost defunct. The plant was almost defunct because you need water to produce steam, and the underground sources of water had been used up. So with Calpine looking for water and Santa Rosa looking for a way to get rid of its sewer water, a partnership was born. Santa Rosa built pipelines with the assistance of Calpine to pump its sewer water, which had been cleaned up enough for industrial use, and pumped it 40 miles north to the geysers. The result is wonderful. For the first time in 120 years, and this was just a couple years ago, for the first time in 120 years, Santa Rosa sewer water was no longer dumped into the Russian River, and Calpine was able to revive the geysers. In fact, the geysers are now the largest renewable energy plant in California, larger than any solar or wind installation, providing electricity close to a million homes. While we describe some smarter thinking in reusing water, such as the geyser, our book also describes some successes among the biggest users of water, agriculture. About 70% of water is used for agriculture, primarily growing our food. And in the United States, we know how to use up a lot of water for food. In fact, if you ask how much water we use, some of you would probably respond that in most American cities, we use, or we may use between 80 to 100 gallons a day. In San Francisco, we've actually gotten that number even much lower. But that is, so to speak, just a drop in the bucket. Our water footprint, the water we use for all our goods, primarily for food, is closer to 1,800 gallons a day per person. How can that be? let me give you some numbers to think about. And I think about them all the time because I love steak. An 8-ounce steak takes about 630 gallons of water to produce. A glass of milk, 53 gallons to produce. You might ask yourself, how does that compute? That cow has to eat a lot of grain or grass, and that cow's food takes a lot of water to grow. The water footprint of the United States is double the world average and about 1.5 times the rest of the developed world. And as other countries gain affluence, they use more water. In China, for example, they have greatly increased their consumption of beef over the last few years. In fact, it's increased by about 40% over the last few years. But whether in the U.S. or in the rest of the world, we can and should improve our agricultural water use. In our book, we describe some cases that provide some hope for improving this agricultural use. In a case from Nebraska, farmers used low-cost, readily available technology to improve their farm output while reducing their water use. In our sampling of agricultural cases from different parts of the world, we believe it is very doable to achieve a 10% savings in agricultural water use. 10% is nothing to sneeze at when you consider that agricultural use accounts for more than 2/3 of our worldwide water use. And scientists studying the link between water and food production believe that a 10% savings could prevent for several decades the impending food shortages caused by increased water shortages. In our book, some of our stories take us many miles away to different hemispheres and cite the major improvements in public health. One of those takes place in Brazil. In Brazil, with a collaborative effort between the government, private contractors, and the affected residents, millions of impoverished families gained access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation through an innovative, low-cost water delivery and wastewater removal system. One of the Brazilian cases involves the slums, or as they are called in Brazil, the favelas, surrounding the federal city, Brasilia. As a favela sprung up around the city, the government provided electricity and running water to the favela's residents. But they didn't provide any means to dispose of their wastewater. So the running water going into the homes, or as they could be best described as shacks, flushed their toilets. But then the sewage waste from the shacks ended up in gullies outside their homes. The result was severe and sometimes deadly diarrhea suffered by their young children. Sometimes there were outbreaks of cholera. Again, with innovation, fairly low-cost technology provided by the government, and the involvement of the residents in actually putting some of the systems in place, they were able to provide basic sanitation to their residents and dramatically improve their public health, particularly the health of their young children. In another town in Brazil, we write about a similar method was employed to bring safe drinking water. We describe smarter thinking in several regions throughout the globe. As we describe these cases, there are some important points that emerge. One, technology is available to improve our water situation. In many cases, these technologies are low cost or pay for themselves in short order. Two, these cases were chosen because they can and should be replicated. Three, for many users, especially the agricultural industry, change did not happen unless they were given an incentive. In the cases we described, it was business as usual until there were economic or regulatory incentives, or a combination of the two. Four, several of our cases involved the public and were only successful with public involvement. In Brazil, involvement meant participation, and in some towns, it actually meant sweat equity. Here in San Francisco, some of you may remember the massive efforts your wastewater utility made in trying to convince you that we needed to invest in our water and our wastewater system. That the investment was not just a good idea, it was essential to the long-term health and prosperity of all San Franciscans. Which brings me to all of us. Come on, whose water is it? It's all of ours. It's not somebody else's. It is our water. It is our future. So as much as I want you to enjoy the book and get a sense of the possible, I want you to get more than a sense. I want you to feel the urgency. We are running out of water, but we can and should make our voices heard to our water utilities, to our elected officials. As we describe in our book, federal elected officials in several hemispheres played a key role in providing incentives to the water industry, and we saw improvements, but not enough improvements. If our water is not a priority to them, it should be. And we can let them know it's our priority. Remember, political will starts with the people. So before I stop and begin to take your questions, let me leave you with some suggestions of what you can do, in addition to buying and reading my book. But some things you can do. You need to become knowledgeable about something that you rely on every day and you need 24/7. Just think what happens when your cell phone goes out for a little bit. We can't even think or envision what would happen if our water goes out. Or when we flush and it doesn't go somewhere. Or if it goes somewhere and pollutes something. So, some things you should know. Who runs your water system? I used to in San Francisco, but who runs your water system if you're not in San Francisco? Will your water supply meet the demands of development and more population? How long will that water supply last? You might have a 30-year mortgage. Will your water last that long? Do you know that? Who runs your wastewater system? Is it in compliance with federal and state laws so it does not pollute as it discharges our wastewater, your wastewater, into the rivers, lakes, or oceans? Are your congressional leaders providing incentives to improve agricultural use? You may not live in a farming district, but you still need to eat. So with that, I will turn it over to Carrie. Thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Susan Leal on the subject, Running Out of Water, the title of her new book. And now we have time for some questions from the audience, the first of which is, how do you respond to the argument, just desalinate? There's plenty of water.
We do address that in our book, but I would like to take on that question and just try to give a quick answer to that. People think of that as a panacea, but let me just give you a couple facts. Desalination takes a lot of energy. You remember I mentioned climate change. So we're going to use up a lot of energy, and that feeds into the climate change equation. The other thing is that environmentally, they've found ways to pull water in to do the desalination. They're doing a little bit better on that, but you still have to dispose of the brine. And it's very expensive. Even with the advancements we've made in desalination, the costs run, and this is right at the source, the costs run anywhere probably in range of $700 to over $1,200 an acre foot. Okay? Farmers, tell farmers in California, are paying more around the range of $50 an acre foot. Imperial Valley, which provides two-thirds of the winter crops, winter green vegetables to the U.S., they pay about $17 an acre foot for water. So unless we're prepared to pay a lot more for our food, desal is something to help out, especially in urban areas. It might provide a bit of a safety valve, but it is not anyway a solution.
Thanks. The next question from our audience is, in the Central Valley Westlands, we grow crops that are subsidized that require huge amounts of water. At the same time, we pay southern farmers not to grow these same crops where there is more water. What can we do about that seeming anomaly?
As I mentioned today and as we address in our book, there are a number of incentives we can give to agriculture to make it more sustainable, make more sense. Right now, we are doing a number of things that don't make sense. There are some farmers that have tried to, not have tried, but have succeeded in making their water use more sustainable. I do believe it's a question for our elected leaders. I think it's something that we should all ask. And why we are supporting food production that is not sustainable.
Thanks. In your book, you mentioned that you were not going to spend a lot of time talking about the small things that individual homeowners and residents or citizens can do to reduce their water usage, and instead concentrate on the big picture of these bigger scale solutions. But here's a particularly interesting question about low-flow water toilets. Are there any good studies of the effectiveness of low-flush toilets compared to traditional ones, given that most low-flush toilets need to be flushed more often?
If the technology has greatly improved in that, and I would say that there are low-flush toilets that are very efficient and take only one flush.
That's my next purchase.
Right.
Given that residential water use is about 10% of the total and ag is about 70%, what are the key things that should be done in the agricultural sector to ratchet down the use of water by in farming?
In a number of different, and as we describe in the book, there is a number of different mechanisms that were put in place. For example, in Australia, they put in a water trading system which helped monetize the value of water. And by doing that, the farmers got a better understanding of their water, and it produced greater output with less water, lower value crops. In other words, they were not using growing lower value crops such as cotton and rice in desert areas, which we do. So there has been some solutions, and those need to be replicated. So the solutions are out there. They've been tried and true, and they need to be replicated.
Thanks. Please comment on China's plan to divert the water of the Himalayas to eastern China. Doesn't this leave Southeast Asia without a major water source?
I can't really comment on that. I have talked with Professor Rogers about that. He has spent quite a bit of time in Cambodia, in Laos, and looking at the possible effects of those water diversions. Whenever you have, and as we discuss in the book, and Professor Rogers is much more of an expert on this, when there is diversion of waters between countries, there have been some good solutions, even between, surprisingly, between India and Pakistan. And there has been some good solutions there. But as we look to, as water is being a move between countries, that those agreements are very tough to put in place, but when they have been put in place, they've been very worthwhile. I think this is one where the U.S. and other more dominant countries, or hopefully dominant countries, will try to prevail in China and make sure that it does not have a lasting negative effect on Southeast Asia.
Thank you. There's two related things. One is has to do with private ownership of water systems, and the other has to do with using market forces to allocate water in ways that make more economic sense. So those can be kind of conflicting things. And so this one question is, do you think there should be an international move to prevent private ownership of water systems? And the other question being, how would you use market mechanisms to produce a better allocation of water between competing uses?
Let me answer it this way. Water is seen as a public good, and I believe it's a public good. At the same time, you need money for water treatment, for water distribution, for wastewater treatment, so that you don't pollute the waterways. And so there needs to be some money put into the system so that you can have safe drinking water, so that you can clean your wastewater. At the same time, and we discuss this in the book, at the same time, being poor should not prevent somebody in gaining access to safe drinking water or to having clean wastewater, having the wastewater cleaned. We showed that, and that was shown in Brazil in several Latin American countries that put a lot of that technology into place. So it is a public good. There have been some good private operators of water systems. So you do need money to run it, but it shouldn't be an impediment for the poor in gaining access.
Thanks. In that same vein, I'm curious as to whether you have heard about the issue up in Northern California. I think it's the McLeod area with the Nestle operation there that's taken water, what used to be a public source, and is using it for bottling.
Actually, we wrote about that in the book because it was a success story, in that the folks in McLeod, it was a very interesting story, and basically they had signed up a close to 100-year deal. The town leaders had signed close to a 100-year deal that would take let Nestle take as much water as they wanted out of the McLeod. And all of a sudden, the residents and some of the folks that use that area for fly fishing, they kind of woke up, and they said, wait a minute. And they got together, and they put a lot of pressure on Nestle. Also, Attorney General Jerry Brown started to ask some questions about whether their environmental assessments, which allowed this agreement, whether those were put together correctly. And long and short, Nestle backed off. So we showed that when people get together and they really make their voices known and their opinions known, things happen. And Nestle was slowed down on this. They moved on to Sacramento, where they're taking the municipal water. And most bottled water, as you know, is municipal water. That's why I have my stainless steel bottle sitting here on the podium, which says, I love San Francisco water, because it's good stuff in that stainless steel bottle.
Let the record show that the water we serve today out front here is Hetch Hetchy water.
Hetch Hetchy.
And that's the last time I will say the phrase Hetch Hetchy. Okay. For those who don't know this, in Susan's role as the head of the PUC, there was a lot of controversy about the Hetch Hetchy system. Earlier you mentioned that there was an underinvestment in water infrastructure every year in the amounts, in the billions of dollars. So this audience member's question is, what do you think it will take to get Washington's attention to increase public investments in water infrastructure?
I'm hoping that more people can make their opinions known, and we won't have to wait to have a series of disasters happen. The folks in Cape Cod, they're getting a very tough lesson right now. And, you know, don't want to go on too long. I want to get to other questions. But, you know, it's very interesting. There was a lot of to-do about the Gulf, which there should have been. It was our largest environmental disaster. And one of the great TV scenes from the Gulf where those signs would say beach closed. And the same time that Gulf disaster was happening, there was beach closed signs in the Great Lakes, in Rhode Island, in the Jersey Shore. And that's because wastewater wasn't properly treated and it was polluting those bodies of water. So unfortunately, it's going to take some big disasters, but I'm hoping that we can raise our hands and let people know that there is a sense of urgency.
So you're recommending a whole lot more beach clothes signs.
Unfortunately, there may have to be before people pay attention, and that's a very sad state of affairs.
People take water, fresh water, for granted. You know, you take things for granted. You flip the light flip the switch and the light comes on. You just sort of take that for granted. You open the water tap, the water comes out. And so I think what you're saying, if I can paraphrase it, is that those things that we take for granted need to be visibly threatened, tangibly threatened, before people will start getting behind the solutions.
I'm afraid so.
So that leads to this next question from the audience. Do you see the improvements and upgrades needed to our water systems as initially requiring one huge PR project?
Well, you can think of it as a PR project, or you can think of people educating themselves. And their water utility should help educate them. And their elected officials should jump on board. But again, I go back to the point I made earlier, is that public will begins with the people. And if we have to speak up.
Right. And that would apply to all of us in the room here, I think. The next question is, what examples have you seen of municipalities that have successfully used investments in water systems as a job creation strategy?
Well, I think San Francisco's one. With our seismic upgrade of our Hetch Hetchy water system. There has been a number of jobs, not only in San Francisco, but in the many towns that system travels through. You remember, you know, that system travels through 167 miles from the High Sierra to the city. And there's several towns that we go through, and our system goes through, and there are jobs being provided. And the same case is happening with our wastewater system, which has been in bad shape for a long time. We should be very grateful to the operators of the system. They've held it together with gum and string, but it's a very antiquated system, and it's now going under a major upgrade, and that will provide jobs as well.
Thank you. One of the phenomena that happens when any resource starts becoming constrained on a global level is that rich countries will shift the problem out of their domain into developing countries or poorer countries. An example is petroleum. We don't want petroleum to be pumped in the Santa Barbara Channel or offshore near us. But we're perfectly happy to have companies pump it out of the ground in the Amazon. For example, recently there's been in the paper a lot of controversy about the Texaco program in Ecuador, which has been very problematic. So when it comes to water, is there the potential for that kind of a transference of the problem from us, a rich country, to poor countries? Just one example comes to mind, and that is that as we run out of water for growing crops or the price of water goes up in the U.S., perhaps we'll be importing food from other countries and thus making their water problem much worse.
I think that's possible, but it's more likely that we're going to have to solve the problem at home because the cost of transporting could become prohibitive.
Have you heard of any equivalent? We have the fair trade labeling that goes on with commodities, food and flowers even, and things like that. Is there any kind of a certification or labeling mechanism that might work for food? I mean for water. And I don't even know what I mean by that.
Well, I think it would be interesting. I know it because that old expression, ignorance is bliss. And before I knew how much water it took to make an 8-ounce steak, I like being ignorant because I love steak. But now I think about it. I think it would be interesting to start putting that on different food items that were very high water.
Yeah, put it on the menu.
Put it on the menu.
This item contains 27 grams of fat and took 800 gallons of water.
This is 30% of your water footprint. Enjoy it today.
Since I know that you like steak, I'm not going to go on my little speech.
You can. You can make me feel guilty.
Can I go on my little speech about feedlots and how horrible
they
are?
Don't go there. I'm one of those people that has to meet the chickens, meet the cows, meet their relatives before I.
But then you go ahead and eat them.
Then I go ahead and eat them.
Right.
Which makes it even worse, I guess.
So, getting serious again for a moment. This question from the audience is, what is the single most important action that should be taken for the long-term viability of the U.S. water supply?
I believe it's in agriculture, and we have seen some improvements, but they have to be more widespread. I believe this administration has paid more attention to that, but it needs to be something that's sustained, and that is the major issue. Is agricultural use?
Right. That's kind of what I've picked up from my reading, including your book. Here's a question from someone who has a career aspect in mind. If you were 29, eager to work, and just moved to San Francisco, who is that? Oh, that person over there. Thank you. What would you do? And who is doing good work? And I assume it means in the public interest in water, environmental conservation, or whatever.
I think the I tell you, the water utilities in the Bay Area do very good work. And I know public employees have gotten a bad rap every now and again, but I'll tell you, I was so pleased to run that water utility and meet many other people in the water utilities, and you know, whether it's East Bay Mud or Sonoma, and really dedicated folks, and very smart, a lot of scientists, engineers, thoughtful people. So that would be one that, you know, NGOs are great, and I'm still very supportive of many of them. But I'll tell you, there's 2,000 people that work 24/7 for the people of the Bay Area, providing them water, and they do good work and very environmentally conscious work.
So the answer to that person is call the PUC and see if they have any openings. Okay. In your book, you talk about the aquifer that's underneath Nebraska and much of the Midwest ag area, and the fact that that's dropping and so forth. There's also an aquifer in other parts of the country, including California.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when those things actually go dry completely or completely depleted?
Well, what motivated the folks in Nebraska to take the action they did to improve their situation and improve their water use was the aquifer under them was dropping. And what was the motivation or the incentive for them to improve was that oil prices had gone up. And it was costing a lot of money to pump the water. The aquifer kept dropping. The hydrostatic pressure kept dropping. And they had to keep pumping deeper and deeper to get the water. And so the energy costs are what turned them around. They said, hey, we got to do something about this water. And actually, the aquifer, the parts of it that are under Nebraska have really shown some real improvement.
And in your book, a very interesting segment was about the farmer named, was it Glock?
Yes, Eugene Glock.
Glock, who did some radical, crazy stuff, and which was quite effective, and showed that the individual farmer can, in fact, make a difference. Is that true?
Well, he did, because he was considered a leader in his community. He put in place a number of bits of technology. They were low cost. They paid off in short order. And they were basic gizmos, if you will, that did things like measure the moisture in the soil. Duh. I mean, you'd think that would be just a natural. But they hadn't been using those. And they started using those. They started measuring how the crops were taking in water. That technology is available. And they made use of it and saw great improvements.
Thanks. Now, here's a question that is one of these examples of maybe climate change can be good for us. And the question is, wouldn't global warming increase the availability of fresh water in the world by way of evaporation of seawater?
Yeah, maybe. But the other side of that is, if the seas were rising, then your wastewater systems that put water out into your bays and ocean would be overwhelmed. A number of other things would be overwhelmed. You would no longer have that natural snowpack. So you'd be out of water most of the year. That natural storage would be gone. So on balance, climate change is bad news, real bad news.
Yeah, thanks. You're preaching to the choir here, I guess, except maybe one. Why does tap water smell? And if it smells, is it still safe? I know it doesn't smell in San Francisco. But
if it smells, it's because it still has some chlorine residual in it. And if you put it in a glass and you leave it out for 10, 15 minutes, if you can pick up that chlorine smell initially, it should go away. What I say to people is if they have some concern about their tap, you could see about approaching your water utility, and likely for a nominal charge, they'll come and test. Also, if you're concerned about your tap water, don't buy bottled water. If you really want to get a filter, if that makes you feel better. But don't buy bottled water. Your tap water is tested tens of thousands of times every year. In San Francisco, they test the water over 80,000 times over the course of a year. Most of the bottled water, many of it comes from tap, and it is under different rules than the tap water. It doesn't need to be continually tested. So if it got bottled and it wasn't such a great batch, or that batch sat there for too long, and the BPA in that bottle somehow was leaching into the water, you're not going to know about it. Also, it's just such a crying shame to produce all those plastic bottles.
Right. In your book, you quoted the famous Mark Twain quote that said something like, whiskey is for drinking, but water is for fighting over. In the West, California, or water is for fighting over. So that leads me to this next question from an audience member. As we now fight for oil, do you foresee a day when we fight, as in go to war, I guess, for water?
It's possible. I'm hoping that we won't see that. But there's you know, questions around the Nile, questions around the Mekong, hopefully smarter people and will prevail.
How about we talked about China earlier, and what's the status of the Three Gorges Dam and their efforts to divert a major source of fresh water for other uses? Is that's proceeding according to plan, I gather?
Yes, the Three Gorges Dam did go forward. There are some real concerns about that. I think the bigger concern for China is just running out of water. They have, of course, population growth. They have, as I mentioned before, they're using more water-intensive food. So with growing affluence, they're using a lot more water.
There's two questions here, I have a sneaking suspicion they were written by the same person. The first one is, how about trying another run for mayor? And the second one is, how about coming back to San Francisco to run the PUC again?
Well, the run for mayor, I have to tell you, I'm having too much fun right now. And as much as I love my city, water is... It's a great issue, and it's very important to me. And I'm having just too much fun in what I'm doing now.
I understand. I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker today is Susan Leal, speaking on the subject of Running Out of Water, which is the title of her new book. We have time for three or four more questions. This one from the audience. What is the role of corporations and private companies in the water allocation debate? Do you think any key players are understanding what's at stake, and are leading the way in water conservation?
There are a number of companies that are very concerned about water supply. Several companies I can think of, IBM being one of them, they are very concerned with the availability of clean water to be able to manufacture, to be able to run their business. And so a number of companies are looking at this, they're studying it, and they do provide also some hopeful voices on this subject.
This audience question is, do European countries have regulations that we could adopt at the federal level? Our system seems to be disjointed. Farm bills, corn ethanol, all those kinds of things. Is there something that from Europe that we could borrow to streamline?
I think there are solutions from all over the world that we need to look at. I mean, we need to look at what they did in Brazil and the public involvement in engaging the residents of Brazil. I'm not saying we need to be asking people for sweat equity, but they got people really involved in their system. They understood their system much more than we do in the U.S. So we always can learn, and other countries can learn from us. Things in Europe and or overseas are not perfect either, or as they say, across the pond. For example, in the UK, there's a terrible problem with their delivery of water. My understanding that they have some real problems in distribution, and there's a lot of problems in – they're looking at desal and a number of other solutions to make sure that the folks in London have enough water.
Right. Are you probably familiar with the Delta Vision Task Force and mm-hmm. the plan for the diverting the water from Northern California, bypassing the Delta? And at the same time, Governor Schwarzenegger is talking about we need even more reservoirs and dams than we have now. Can you give the audience a quick update about where that Delta Vision plan or the proposal to build what used to be referred to as the peripheral canal, where that stands?
I think a lot of these programs are talking about things that need a lot more money, and the state's not putting up that money, and they're not putting bonds before the voters to provide any of that money. I think as we go forward with that debate on the Delta, we have to look at how we're using the water in the southern part of the state. Right now, as you know, we have 70% or 75% of our population is southern end of the state, but all our water is in the northern end of the state. The water coming through the Delta is very precarious. As the Department of Interior, their recent report they put out, it is a sinking heart of the state, the Delta. The Delta is literally sinking, and it's on the verge of a real catastrophe. So the Delta, there needs to be some solutions to the Delta. I don't know what the state's coming up for the money with that. I think they need to put something before the voters to see if there's something we can come forward to help that situation. But at the same time, we should be looking at how water is being used in the southern end of the state. In our book, we do write about some of the counties that are being more forward-looking. Surprisingly, Orange County, which we like to think of as conservative and more reactionary, they were really forward-looking in terms of their water. And they did some good things. And we need to be asking some of the other counties, what are they doing as they ask for more water from the north?
In your book, you have a case study on Orange County, which was quite interesting, because I realized that they're no longer the John Birch Society state. But I didn't realize that they were actually progressive on these things, so I was happy to hear about that. Here's another question. What needs to happen on the national level to address these challenges? Is Congressman Blumenauer's Water Trust Fund a solution, and what does the EPA need to do?
A trust fund would be a solution if it was large enough. Right now, some of the trust funds that I've talked about, and I don't know the specifics where it is – the size of the trust fund right now that he's put forward. But my understanding of those trust funds, they were not large enough to really make a significant change in and really shore up the funds we need for infrastructure.
We're getting to the point where we have maybe time for just one or two more questions. What could an individual citizen do other than, you know, the low flush toilet and get rid of your lawn and go in for gardening that is native water tolerant or drought tolerant plants, all that kind of thing. But on the bigger picture, what can an individual citizen do to bring pressure to cause these big scale solutions to get moving?
I think some of the solutions that we'd outline in our book, and actually that I mentioned here today, you need to ask your elected officials. What are they doing? You need to ask your water utilities. Do they have enough water? Are they treating your wastewater properly? It's fair game to ask them. What are they doing about incentives for agriculture? And if it's not your representative, write to another representative. Have your friends write to a representative. And we all get emails from our different representatives. Respond to some of those and say, gee, I think you're doing a good job. And will you look at this? Because this is important to me, and it's important to all of us and to our future.
Thank you. You've been listening to Susan Leal, author of the new book, Running Out of Water. This is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, observing over a century of enlightened discussion, and this meeting is now adjourned.